Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be finishing up our Shocktober celebration with a movie by Star Trek's newest director, Vincenzo Natali. And that movie is Cube.
Yeah, man, I'm looking forward to talking about this, actually.
Yeah, it also really has Nicole DeBoer in it.
So another Star Trek connection.
Yes, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
A couple of years before she showed up on Deep Space Nine as Ezri Dax. Yeah. So, okay, Vincenzo Natali, it's been announced that he is the producing director on Star Trek Discovery. What that means is that he's basically the director in residence, I guess you could say. He won't be directing every episode, but he's kind of like the director showrunner in a sense. The other directors will sort of be following his lead in terms of their style and their approach and various things. And Natali has directed a lot of stuff over the years. In recent years, he's become a pretty prolific television director. He directed an episode of Luke Cage recently. He's doing, the episode of Westworld, which just aired on Sunday. And also Wayward Pines, The Strain, Orphan Black, Hannibal,
Hannibal.
Yeah. Even Earth Final Conflict, which we talked about back on Commentary Trek Stars.
Ah, yes.
But in addition to these things, he's also made a number of features such as Splice, which is a horror film from a few years back, which was pretty well received. He did a segment in Paris Je T'aime, an anthology movie, which was very good, by the way. And he's also the director of this movie, which was his very first movie, Cube. For those people who may not be familiar with Cube, would you like to give a synopsis of it?
I would love to. Okay, the broadest brushstroke, because I don't want to like give anything away, but a bunch of people basically find themselves stranded inside a box, a room that is a box, with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 exits, and they find that the each room is basically a different environment. Some rooms are safe, some rooms have traps, and everybody's trying to get out. So, of course, naturally, as they're trying to figure out the safe way to get out, bad things happen, worse things happen, other bad things happen. But along the way, everybody's character comes into focus. It is very much a character piece. It's less about the cube and more about the people in it, naturally. But just how these different personalities play against each other and play off of each other in a survival situation. And it's a pretty intriguing film.
It is an interesting film. It's a very interesting film. And one of the things which makes it so interesting is the way that it's done. You know, this is obviously a low-budget movie from a first-time director. I mean, an indie for all practical purposes. And he really utilizes the resources at his disposal in order to tell a much larger story than he has any right to, in a sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He does that thing that you're looking for science fiction television directors to do. He gets a lot of bang for his buck and makes, you know, something which seems like a massive scale by essentially shooting the entire thing in one set, in one room.
Yeah, well, I mean, all he needs is two rooms. He needs the room that they're in and the room that they're going into, regardless of where that room is. Mm-hmm. And just turn them or the camera or the room around as necessary, and then relight the panels. Because the art direction in it is particularly again, to, you know, speak to your point, is great because, you know, everything's modular. So if you want to make it look like a different room, you relight it, maybe swap out two of the panels, you know, so that panel A is where panel Z was, and it looks like a different room.
Yeah.
And it's pretty great. And, I, you know, very, very interesting in just sort of the, like, what it reminded me of in a sense was, and, you know, I sort of, this is sort of a crush for me to fall back on, but it reminded me in a sense of the first time I ever saw Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Where this actually pulls off, in a sense, even more so what Reservoir Dogs, what that impressed me with, where I was like, this could be a stage play. You don't even need the stuff that's set outside the room, or if you do, it's just them standing in different lighting. You could do this on stage. This doesn't even have like the flashbacks to outside of the room, mm-hmm. or the cube, as it were. Everything is established through dialogue and interaction. There is no cheat. There's no traveling outside to get inside a character's head. There's no traveling outside to tell something about their backstory. It's all about what they say to each other, how they react to what's being said, and then, you know, going from there. Just the way that the characters progress, they don't necessarily go in directions that you expect, right? Like the guy who, at the beginning, you sort of, you're like, yeah, take charge guy, and then by the end, you have a different impression of him. Like, I'm trying very hard not to give anything away, because I really do think that this is something worth seeing. It's an hour and a half, and it's, you know, it's not asking a lot of you to just go and catch it.
Yeah, no. That's true. And you know, it is really interesting how, like, he utilizes that space, you know, like you're saying, you know, it could be a stage play, but I almost think it would be hard to make it a stage play, because a lot of it is, you know, a lot of the movement, or all of the movement, is going from one room to the next. And one of the ways that he's able to make it so much, you know, larger than it really is really through the editing, you know? Mm. I mean, and the way that he uses the camera to sort of like convey space is interesting, and the way that he's able to sort of like, you know, cut different angles together in order to sort of like use this visual language to make it clear what's going on is and where it's going on is really, really impressive.
Well, okay. Now, see, you, as has been well established through the years, you know much more about the technical aspects of things like camera usage and stuff like that than I do. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of moments in this where the camera is, you know, in a corner looking up, and it's taking in the whole room, or it's from above and it's taking in the whole room, and everybody's in the shot. And obviously they've had to put the camera, you know, pull it back as far as they can physically to get everybody in. And there's this sort of flat effect that happens as a result. Is that simply an artifact of the type of cameras that they were using, or cameras in general? Or is that an artistic decision that a director makes to heighten? Because watching it, my impression was that it was very disorienting. It felt like I got in with the characters of like this, you know, how do you get out? I'm trapped in, you know, with these people, and I feel how disoriented they are. Or is that just a beneficial side effect of the fact that when you take a camera and you move it to this angle in this square, you know, cube environment, it's going to flatten the image naturally?
You know, I'm not 100% sure what you're referring to. You know, I think it would be easier if we were to see it, but
sure.
I think what you're describing, which would make sense given the scenario and the type of shot or whatever, would be like the result of a wide angle lens, which creates a bit of distortion on the sides. Like if you think of like a fish-eyed lens, like that's like the widest of wide angles. So I'm not saying that it would be like that wide, but it has sort of that effect on things to a smaller scale. And in addition to being able to see much more of what's there, it also basically has a very, very large depth of field. So basically everything is in focus. There is no, like nothing at all would be out of focus. But there's going to be some like distortion, sort of like rounding of the edges at times.
Okay. All right. Then maybe it was a decision, because all of the shots that I'm thinking of are later on in the film. Nicole DeBoer is in extreme close field, you know, and then everybody else is in the background.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
One character walks to mid, but everybody's out of focus but her.
Mm-hmm.
But the image still feels very flat compared to the way it's shot in the rest of the film. So it must have been an artistic decision to convey that character's state at that time.
Yeah, yeah, I think I know what shot you're talking about there. Yeah, and I think that's accurate. You know, I mean, you kind of see that. Actually, you see that a lot in Reservoir Dogs and also in Star Trek the Motion Picture. Although in those they use like a split diopter so that the background is in focus as well, which is kind of a cheat of sorts, which I don't particularly like, but whatever.
You and I are in agreement on that. I don't care for that cheat myself either. I think that another good thing to call out is Natalie, and especially I'm most familiar with his TV work on Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
Color saturation apparently was in his DNA from the beginning.
Yeah. Right?
Like there's some real color saturation going on in these shots. And, you know, that you see that carried through in Hannibal. And I'm actually very excited to see what he can do with that with a starship. Like, what's the engine room going to be lit like? And those sorts of things. Like, I'm trying not to get ahead of myself or get too hopeful, but I would think that since this is a strong visual sense that has carried him through, apparently, from the very beginning, that we're going to see that come into Discovery.
Well, especially when you take into account things that Fuller and others have said about sort of, you know, calling on the past in terms of the look of the show. Like, I would be shocked if the uniforms are not, you know, red, blue, and gold. And, you know, I would be shocked if there weren't a lot of, you know, primary colors built into the color palette of the show or whatever. So I think that you could really expect that in a lot of ways, you know? And yeah, I mean, using the color here, you know, like lighting the room, basically there's these panels on all of the walls and, you know, they'll enter one room and it'll be all green and they'll enter one room and it'll be all blue, you know. I think that that's sort of a genius way of going about this because, yeah, you're using one set and yeah, you're you know, trying to find ways to go from one room to the next, and they all are, you know, essentially the same, but to differentiate them by color, I mean, even if the colors, you know, don't necessarily mean anything in terms of the story, I mean, maybe they do, maybe they don't, the fact that they made that choice, I think was pretty brilliant, just because it makes the movie more visually interesting, you know? Yes, it is the same set, you know, one scene after the other, but, you know, it's different visually just because of the lighting which is used, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a smart choice. You know, it's a smart, cheap choice that they made.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
I think that the sound design in this is extremely good, too. They really give a weight to those doors that makes them feel even heavier than probably the set piece actually was. Like, it's a really good example of how sound editing, or not sound editing, but like sound design makes a real difference in your perception of a scene and your perception of a moment in that scene. Every time they turn that lever, especially at the very beginning, it's so, like, it really does add to the tension of everything. So with the color and the sound design, I mean, you know, this is a guy that I think is really going to find a great deal of comfort on a starship.
Yeah, yeah, no, I totally agree with you with that sound design, like with those doors, you know, because you can kind of see like the real world seams in a sense, like, you know, the doors, they have a great sort of like double opening thing where like they pop out and then slide down, you know, that kind of thing, which is sort of like a great, you know, futuristic type of way to open a door instead of just having like a hinge. But like at some points in some shots, you can see like the tracks which they use. And the tracks are like, it's like that looks way flimsier than the sound you have associated with it. But, you know, you totally buy it because of that sound. I mean, it's great. And yeah, as far as, you know, him being suited to you know, a science fiction show. I mean, I think the other thing that we see here, which is really, really great and probably the most significant thing about this movie in relation to his work on Disco, is the fact that he has a good sense of science fiction. You know, I mean, this is like a high concept sci-fi movie, which he did for, you know, basically no money, you know, I mean, relatively speaking. And, you know, I think lots of times people are scared away from doing sci-fi because how do you do it? You know, how do you do it as an indie filmmaker? And it's very, very rare that someone's able to pull it off. I mean, George Lucas, in a sense, with THX-1138, even though that movie is massive in scale compared to this one, you know, you know, you could look at Primer, the movie by, what's his name, Shane Carruth, where the guys build the time machine in their garage.
I don't know that one.
Oh, watch that movie.
Okay.
And then explain to me what happens in it.
Okay.
No, I mean, you know, they made it for like $6,000 in their garage, you know, but it's a, you know, really, really, really high concept sci-fi movie.
But see, doesn't that speak to sci-fi can sometimes be, it's like we're very used to being bludgeoned with, you know, lots of effects. Yeah. And, you know, oh, the, you know, we got to redo the warp effects and the transporter effects and all of that stuff. But sci-fi, I think, really benefits sometimes from a limited budget where, you know, okay, convince the audience with your acting, but at the same time, forcing a director or a producer or a show crew, whomever, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. You figure out what you have to do to make the scene work or make the story work. And so I think that, you know, if you give a different director $50 million to make this movie, I guarantee you have a scene where you're climbing around on the outside of a cube at some point.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas somebody making this movie, especially, you know, a first time director saying, OK, well, I have $5 million and I can't do everything I want to. So let's figure out how to make this compelling. You
yeah,
know?
No, that's totally true. And your concept needs to be really solid and sort of figuring out, you know, ways to do things with ideas instead of with, you know, massive visuals or whatever. I mean, that's cool. Even if he is going to have a much larger budget for Star Trek or whatever, he is going to be able to use crazy special effects in order to tell these stories. Just having that background, having that mentality, I think will bring a lot to this much larger concept, you know?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, he'll have access to more resources, but you know, to speak to your point, his perspective will be he's going to just sort of naturally fall into getting as much in frame as he can. And then when they add the effects, it's just background. It, you know, like it's like having a star field in a window outside. You know, I might need to see that while they're at warp and they're in the captain's room or whatever. But what's going on in the captain's room and how the captain's room is lit and how it's designed, that's what I'm focused on. You know, yeah. The rest is just background fluff.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay, he's done a lot of television. I haven't seen most of it. I still haven't watched Luke Cage, I know. I'm sorry. And you know, the Westworld episode will not have or hasn't aired by the time that we recorded this, although I will watch it as soon as it does air. But like you said that you've seen his Hannibal episodes, of course.
Yes.
What do you think about them? Do they stand out to you?
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I'll give credit to friend of the show, Adam Drosen, who referred to Natalie's work in the first, there are a couple of episodes he does at the beginning of season 3 of Hannibal. And he said they're next level. Oh my gosh. There's one scene in an episode where he does, where he uses a kaleidoscope effect while Hannibal and Will are having a discussion, but they're not actually in that environment. And like, it's just, it's so incredibly visually compelling that you want to stop at, you know, at the break and go back and rewatch it because you're like, what did I just see? What just happened with this? And so I think that was sort of his hallmark with a couple of things in Hannibal was his episodes were always the ones where there would be a segment or an entire episode where at the end of it, you wanted to rewatch it because you were paying so much attention to the visuals that you almost lost the plot, which sounds like a knock, but it's not. But like you were just so in it. You so believed this world that was created. A lot of it, fantastical moments. It's a difference between knowing how a trick is done and then just going along with it and saying, oh, that's a neat card trick. And seeing somebody do a magic trick and saying, I got to see you do that again because I don't know how you did that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's what I would classify most of his Hannibal work as.
So now I know you've watched The Strain as well, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so he did the last two episodes of season two.
Oh, those are good episodes.
Yeah?
Those are very good. Yeah, the Battle of New York, essentially.
All right.
Quality stuff.
All right. Well, that's cool. For those people, just because this is the new stuff which is coming out, and I mean, just so that everyone's aware, if you want to check out his work, or if more likely, if you've just seen his work, he did the fourth episode of Luke Cage and the fourth episode of Westworld. But yeah, I'm very excited about his involvement with the show, and part of it is because of this movie. I mean, this is one of those movies. It came out when I was in high school, and you know, everyone sort of like talked about it because it was such an unusual thing to see. You know, an indie sci-fi movie. Those don't come along too often, and this one, you know, really really stood out. So yeah, my friend Zach is a huge fan of this movie, and when I saw that Natalie was going to be working on Disco, my ears perked up quite a bit because when I saw it, my ears perked up, whatever, because it's exciting to see what he's going to bring to the show. So okay, before we go, Nicole DeBoer is in this movie.
Yeah.
And this is, like we were saying, 2 years before she showed up on Deep Space Nine. Now, I hadn't seen it until after she appeared on DS9, but what did you think about her performance in this?
It was good. She was distinct from Esri, but if you really, you know, I've seen it more than once, and every actor has a go-to for, you know, certain reactions and stuff like that. And so, you know, it was like, oh yeah, okay, that carried over to Esri, but that's not a knock. That's just being able to, you know, recognize some of an actor's go-to mannerisms. She's very good. And she, you know, is very, it seems like a strange word to use, but she's very convincing. For me, the mark of any good performance that's worthy of note is that you forget you're watching an actor and you buy the person that's on screen. And I think she achieves that in this. Absolutely.
Yeah. I thought she was really good too. I mean, I'm a big fan of her, you know, portrayal of Esri on Deep Space Nine. And, you know, it was great seeing her here. And, she really does kind of, stand out in this. I mean, not that the other actors are bad, by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I think that she's really fantastic in this movie. So
if you've caught the gist, everybody, go and rent. This is on iTunes. I think it's $3 for standard definition and $4 for high def rental.
I'm pretty sure. And I'm pretty sure, at least when I got it, it was only like $6 to buy. So in HD.
Yeah, iTunes is getting really sneaky about their price points. They're starting to figure it out, man. And because Green Room's only like $9 to own.
Yeah, I was,
and
like,
so like it's right at that price point where you're looking to rent it, and you're like, maybe I do want to own it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I did with Westworld. I'm like, I'll just spend the extra $2 and buy it.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's well worth, you know, the few dollars that you would spend on it. And it's a really good movie. And you know, I haven't seen Natalie's other movie, Splice. I mean, he's done a few other movies, but his other big one is Splice. But if you're looking for something, if you're looking to extend your Shocktober experience, I would probably recommend checking that one out because just the posters and the trailers and everything for that movie scare me so much that I haven't watched it yet, mainly because of that.
If I'm thinking of the correct poster, my impression of it was, oh, it looks like somebody did Species, but right.
Yes, yes, I think that's the poster that you're, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, all right. Well, any final thoughts on Cube?
No, a great way to end your Shocktober, and happy Halloween, everybody.
I guess we have gone out on a high note, for sure, yeah. It's weird because I always think of this as being a sci-fi movie, so much so that I was like, does it really count as horror? Can we? But watching it, I mean, the very first scene, you're like, yep, no, yeah, that's horror.
Yeah, no, definitely horror. Definitely horror. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely check it out. Well, it's been fun talking about Cube today, but that's not all we're talking about this week on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
We can't forget the best part of this episode, absolutely, hands down, is how tight Spock's pants are in this episode. He has got some epically tight pants.
You know, Brendan, I wasn't really paying attention to that, so I'll take your word for it.
But he's like,
yeah, Brendan, I can't say I noticed that. Yeah.
Literary Treks.
Because I love the idea that you have all these artifacts that all do something different with time. And how do you prevent them from being used?
Saturday Morning Trek.
Remember, principal photography hasn't even started yet. So these concept designs are just that, concepts. If this was 1976, you'd be getting sketches. And disco.
Melodic Treks.
Those are totally, like, you could clearly tell that they were going for a Mamas and the Papas kind of vibe with the music that they were doing, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So be sure to check out these shows and discover what's happening in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, click the subscribe button. Leave us a review. You know, that really helps, and it makes us feel special and warm and fuzzy inside. If you're not an Apple user, you can find us at various other places like Stitcher, which is my preferred podcasting app, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, or you could just download the file right from the website. We want to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman Z. Lau.
Thank you.
Yeah, we couldn't do it without you. And if you want to be like Chris, Jeff, and Norm, you can help us out by becoming a patron of the network on patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. If you go there, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find our listener forum, the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we'll pop up. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. Look for me on Words with Nerds, co-hosted with my pal Craig Sorrell. And look for me on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast over on the Nerd Party Network with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing. And Mike, where can people discover you?
You can discover me right here on Trek FM doing From There to Here, which is our daily rewatch show, where we look at all 729 episodes of the franchise from beginning to end. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, that was fun doing the Shocktober thing.
Yeah.
Got Halloween coming up in a few days.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you guys can we've given you some good recommendations to check out.
And I think as a public safety message, a PSA, public service announcement, I want to warn everybody, do not buy the masks that are made by Silver Shamrock. I have it on good authority that they are not safe and that you should not watch their special commercial that they are going to air on Halloween night. I have it on good authority.
Okay. Sounds good. I won't do that then. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week about something we're not exactly sure what yet.
We'll let you know. Thank you.